Welcome back to Kodiak and Conspiracies. I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jade.
All right. Take number 52. Yes. Just a quick reminder, we are going to be taking a break soon, you guys. This is our second to last episode before the break. So we'll have one today, like you're listening to it, and then we'll have another episode on the 23rd, and then we'll break on the 30th and the 6th, just so you guys know. Throwing that out there. We're Kodiak Conspiracies on Instagram, but we can just go ahead and hop straight to it. So, I decided to do another, assassination episode of somebody that you may not have heard of I had heard of, but I didn't really know that much about it. It's not as much of a conspiracy. There is like a slight conspiracy, but, you know, it's pretty much like cut and dry. It's similar to like the Emmett Till murder. And this is the assassination of Medgar Evers. Do you know who that is?
I don't know who that is. I don't know who that
is. Like I said, I had heard his name before, but I wasn't really like that familiar with like his work and like civil rights movement or anything like that. Nor did I know he had been assassinated. So it was kind of a new territory for me, but I thought it was really interesting and it was something that came up when I was researching, so I figured why not. So Medgar Evers, I feel like I'll go over, you know, kind of who he was, because I feel like he's not like a, you know, like a Martin Luther King or a Malcolm X. Like, you might want a little bit of backstory. So he was born on July 2nd, 1925, which, goddamn, that's a long time ago. in Decatur, Mississippi. And he was the third of five children. And his family actually owned a small farm in Mississippi. And his dad also worked at a sawmill. So it's not like they were poor, but they also weren't that well off. Like a lot of black families in this era, they kind of just like were making ends meet, getting food put on the table. And, you know, his parents had like, you know, pretty modest jobs. And he actually earned his high school diploma, which was kind of out of the norm for black children in that area in that time, especially like male black children. So they usually would just go to work or something to support their family. But he actually earned his high school diploma, and then later on ended up earning his college degree, but that was later on down the road. So after he earned his high school diploma, he actually served in the United States Army during World War II, and he served in the Army from 1943 to 1945. And he actually fought in the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944. So he, at the end of that war, he was honorably discharged as a sergeant. And he talked a lot about how his time in the military kind of shaped his fight for civil rights, or his like kind of like interest in it, because he felt like he did, like I'm sure a lot of black soldiers did at this time, they went, you know, to other countries and did all this extra to fight for their country and make sure people have freedom and processes here in the United States. And then he kind of realized when he got back to the Jim Crow South, he had no rights, like basically no rights that he should have. So it's like, oh, you can send me over to basically almost die for you, but when I come back, I can't drink from the same water fountain, I can't use the same bathroom, I can't eat where you eat, but it's okay to send me over to fight in a war and risk my life. So that kind of was like the spark of how he decided he was going to get more into like the civil rights movement. And once he got back was when he actually enrolled in college. And he, you know, was really active in the college. He was on the debate team, the football team, track team. He was a really great athlete, sang in the choir, and he eventually earned his bachelor's of arts in 1952. And that's also where he met his wife, who was also a civil rights activist in her own right. Her name was Merle Lee Beasley. And, they had ended up having three children together and staying married until his, death in 1963. So, after he married his wife, they ended up moving to a town called Mound Bayou, Mississippi. And this was actually a town that was developed by African Americans, which was kind of rare for the time. He worked a few different jobs. Like, he was in like life insurance, and he was a president of a few companies and things like that. One of the most notable companies he worked for was the Regional Council of Negro Leadership. And they kind of began to organize different like sit-ins, rights, actions for civil rights. And this was kind of like his, you know, getting his foot in the door as far as civil rights movement mm-hmm. went. So he helped to organize a few of their things as far as like the boycott of gas stations that denied black people restrooms and, you know, denied black people coming in front doors or any of the other like, you know, Jim Crow style policies and procedures that you hear about. So this was kind of his foray into civil rights activism. And they had their civil rights conferences in Mississippi between 1952 and 1954. And this was actually not a small group. It was a really popular group. Whenever they would have their conferences, they actually would draw crowds of like 10,000 people or more.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was a big
yeah
to do. Like, it wasn't just some podunk Mississippi mm-hmm. whatever. Take a sip of my drink.
There's no dark liquor today.
Mm-mm. There's no dark liquor, just a little wine. That's all, you know. So in 1954, after the ruling of Brown versus Board of Education, which kind of solidified that segregated public schools were not constitutional. So like, you know, the whole separate but equal mm-hmm. thing, that was ruled that was unconstitutional. So after that, he decided he was going to apply to the University of Mississippi Law School. And his application was actually rejected because of his race, even though it wasn't supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But you know how that goes. His application was still rejected. And he actually turned around and submitted the application as part of like a, they call it like a test case or a, I don't know what else you might call it. I'm like, how do I explain this? Basically like something that they can look into to say like, oh, is this fair? Is this not? Mm-hmm. And he submitted that to the NAACP as for them to look into and see if like, you know, his application was rejected fairly or unfairly. And that's actually how he kind of got into working with the NAACP. So he was actually their first field secretary in Mississippi, and he organized tons of boycotts. He set up new local chapters of the NAACP and basically got the ball rolling there as far as a lot of things he was involved in were like voter rights and voter suppression. So he worked a lot in Mississippi as far as that. And he, you know, the Brown versus Board of Education decision affected him. So he worked a lot in that arena as well, as far as like schools and separate equal and segregation in the schools. So as you can imagine, this kind of why you make
activism,
that face?
Like what? Like it pissed people off?
Oh yeah, it pissed people off. Like they were mad as hell. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's in Mississippi, right? Like he's in like the deep South, like Jim Crow South. And he's like, oh, you know, I'm not going to go to a different school, or I'm not going to, you know, eat at a different restaurant than you eat at. And the Klan was really, really active in this town, in this area of Mississippi. So as you can imagine, he started getting death threats. He started getting people calling him, saying they were going to kill him, literally telling him how many hours he had left to live, saying they were going to kill him that night. And it was so bad that he actually had his children do drills and procedures. Like I mentioned, him and his wife had three kids. Mm-hmm. And they actually did like drills and procedures for like bombings, shootings, because people would, you know, threaten them and come to their house. So his children knew like even what to do in the event of someone coming to bomb their house or someone coming to shoot into their house, because they genuinely believe that the threats were, you know, not to be taken lightly, which they clearly weren't, because don't do that. I mean he was
I mean,
right.
Hey,
he wasn't wrong. I mean, it's real sad, but he wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
So in the weeks leading up to his assassination, he actually was looking into a lot of like high profile cases, one of them being the lynching of Emmett Till. So he did a public investigation of that, and obviously like that kind of like catapulted him into the front of, you know, getting more recognition as a Black leader. So he was very outspoken about the case for on Emmett Till, the treatment of it, how it wasn't fair that they basically acquitted these men or were going to acquit these men from an all-white jury. And that really, really made people mad in Mississippi. And so on, they said on May 28th, a Molotov cocktail was actually thrown into his home, which...
What is that?
I don't even know what a Molotov cocktail is.
Like a bomb?
I think it's like a bomb. So from what I understand, it's kind of like a, like you might fill it with like gasoline or something. It's just like a flammable liquid. So I guess something to try to like blow, light something up or blow something up, catch it on fire. Kind of like a ghetto bomb or whatever the fuck.
A homemade.
Mm-hmm, like a homemade, like janky ass bomb.
Oh, when you look it up, this is like in every civil rights movie ever.
A Molotov cocktail?
Yeah, this is really like those little bombs.
Is that what that dude was throwing? And do you remember the Ferguson, or was that Ferguson, the uprisings where the guy was, or was he throwing, what was he doing? There's like a picture from like one of the current, like,
I think it is.
Is that a Molotov cocktail?
Yeah, because it's like the flame. Like, I think it's like, I guess, it looks like it's like a, well, everyone will recognize it. Mm-hmm. But it's basically when you put the rag, I guess, with the gasoline.
Yeah.
Like, into the, yeah, it's that.
But I thought that was something the police threw, and he was, like, throwing it back.
Well, who knows, right? Because that was, like, smoking, kind of, I guess. Yeah. And these aren't, so, like, yeah, that's what I thought it was, too. But what was that other movie I saw? I'm not going to waste people's time, so... the movie where the Black guy fakes to be a cop and gets in with, like, the Ku Klux... No, not fakes to be a cop. So it's a Black guy becomes a cop and fakes with the Ku Klux Klan.
The Denzel Washington son movie.
Yes. In that.
Yeah, Black Klansman. Yeah, that is Denzel's son. Did you like that movie?
I thought it was entertaining. Right. I enjoyed... Well, I saw my mother, but I enjoyed watching it.
I saw it in the theaters. It was pretty hard.
I didn't pay to see it.
Okay.
Well, I thought that's maybe why I enjoyed it a little more. Because it was free to me.
But yeah. Yeah, it was pretty good. But yeah, it's probably like I said, it's just like a little makeshift bomb. People make them a lot of times. Like you said, I guess it was like a prominent thing to do in the civil rights movement. And they said also on June 7th, he was... almost run over by a car after he came out of the NAACP office in Jackson, Mississippi. So people were really actively trying to kill him, which I guess if you know anything about the civil rights movement, may not be that shocking, but to me it's shocking. Like, it's not shocking that they try to do it, but it's like, just when I think about it, like, imagine living in like constant fear
for your life.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you can't even go home. You can't go anywhere without somebody trying to run you down with a car or blow you up. Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, just because you want, like, basic human rights. Or like,
because you
want
to vote.
Isn't that crazy? And I always wonder, like, why are people so motivated? Like, how do you have so much freelance time? And what is your motivation to literally stalk someone down and decide that I'm going to kill them because of this? Like, I hate their race so much. I'm going to do this. Like, we still see it today. Like, remember that lady who had bought that house and her neighbors were doing all types of wild shit. Like, they were stalking her house.
And
he left poop or something. And then, like, once it got viral, random people were, like, volunteering to serve my house because the cops were doing it. I'm like, I always be like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, and the cops were basically like, oh, sorry, we can't.
Yeah.
But the thing about that, her name was, like, Jennifer something. Mm-hmm. But the thing about that was that pissed me off, right? So when she basically called the police and were like, hey, my white neighbors are terrorizing me. They're sending me death threats. Like you said, leaving shit on my porch and, like, saying, like, go die, nigger, and spray painting or whatever. The cops were like, oh, I'm sorry, we can't do anything because, like, they haven't actually harmed you or whatever the fuck. Okay, cool. But as soon as all those Black men camped out in front of her
house,
then the police showed up. Pause. They haven't done anything either. So now I'm confused as to why all of a sudden now you can show up. Like, before you were like, oh, sucks to suck. Yeah. But now that she has these people camped out in front of her house, like, okay, cool. If the police aren't going to protect you, we're going to protect you. Now the police show up.
All of a sudden.
How bizarre. Like... That's ridiculous. But yeah, it's like you said, people still do that to this day. I don't understand. Like, it's like, bro, get a life.
Yeah, like, it's not really
literally
shocking.
Get a life.
Yeah, because I was like, oh, like, that's crazy. He was, like, getting his kids to perform drills and stuff like that. But it's crazy because you can still, like, relate that to today. Like, there are still, like, that Jennifer, as I guess she prefers to go by. Like, literally, the same thing was going through, like, the same thing.
Yeah.
So.
And it's like, son, like, it's like, it's a neighborhood. Just go inside your house and mind your business. Nobody's it's even so talking weird. To
but
you.
It's like, again, like, the police enabled it. Like, they let this man do this so long that he felt that he could comfortably poop on people's yards and things like that. Because
it's not funny, but it's just like, why would you do something like that?
Yeah, like,
it's insane.
Yeah, and you feel so comfortable that you will have no type of, like, I guess, consequences for doing that. So you're like, I'm just going to do whatever I want. And then... just nothing, like, near us. I don't know if you heard this, but apparently, like, in a popular, like, tourist area by us, have you heard this? That this family, like, this Muslim family, like, rented a house.
Oh, yes! Yeah,
and the neighbors, again, felt comfortable enough that whoever it was donning themselves in, like, a Ku Klux Klan outfit and felt comfortable, like, patrolling the house in the outfit. Why are you making the face?
Because all I can think of... is that meme where it's like, it does concern me a little bit, but you know, you come around me, I pack that thing too, you will get clapped. The fuck?
That's what I thought about the Jennifer thing too, though, because I was like, all right, poop my lawn again, and you'll never poop again. That'll be the last poop you take. Like, I hope you enjoyed it. I literally hope you did. Like,
literally, like, what the fuck? So, like you said, people be so bold. This like saying, you really so bold as to show up, and they said it was in broad daylight. You really showing up in a Klan outfit in broad daylight. This one said, I will punch you in your fucking throat. Why are you playing with me?
But to feel so comfortable to do so, and it's like. I guess a rental is harder because it's like, what is it? Second Amendment, I guess.
Yeah,
does it cover a rental? But I feel like now that I have a little piece of property.
Hey, Jay bought a house.
Yeah, I know, right? You know, like I said, you come right around this way.
You will get clapped.
Let me tell you, you will get clapped.
Literally. Like, that's just so crazy. Like, son, like, what the fuck? Like, people, like you said, people are very bold and... it's like one of those things where it's like, okay, I guess, like, obviously back in the civil rights movie, the Jim Crow South, you couldn't just
clap white people.
You couldn't clap white people because they would come back and clap you time since.
And your family.
And your family too.
They clap your generation and your family been cursed for 10 years.
For 10 years.
Because you whistled at one white woman and now your family has been cursed for years.
Literally. Yeah. And they won't let it go.
It was a different.
But nowadays, the fact that they still feel so emboldened and empowered to do these things is like, bro, this isn't the Jim Crow South. Like, we're not doing this here in 2020. Like, I will kill you.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing is, though, like you said, it's like we're not doing it in 2020, but I feel like the fact that you feel so comfortable to do it, some aspects of our
law, we are doing
obviously it. Our law enforcement, we still are, because there really is not any really ramification. Like, the laws around, like, hate speech and things like, well, they're, I think, like, hate speech actually technically, like, isn't illegal because you have, like, the rights of speech. Or it gets really, really complicated with the Constitution and things like that. It gets really complicated where it's actually pretty hard to actually, like, convict somebody for things like that. It gets really complicated.
It does. Yeah. So, yeah, like we were saying, he lived in, like, the constant threat of being killed, being assaulted, being assassinated. And he was actually had two FBI, quote, escorts. So this is kind of like where a little bit of the conspiracy comes in. And he usually, when he went home, because he would stay out late a lot of evenings, going to meetings, meeting with different people. And usually when he came home, he was followed home by two FBI cars and one police car. And that was kind of like his regular thing. The night that he, or the morning, it was about 12:30 a.m. that he arrived home of his assassination, he had no escorts and no police cars. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody had escorted him home that night. And still to this day, they don't know why that was. No one escorted him. Because it was pretty out of the norm because, like I said, he was getting all these death threats. But the speculation was that a lot of the members of the police force in Mississippi at that time were members of the Klan. I'm about to say, I mean, speculation, but so that could, you know, possibly have something to do with the fact that they were like, oh, you know, you'll be fine tonight. So at around 12:30 a.m. on June 12th in 1963, Evers pulled into his driveway after he left a meeting with his NAACP lawyers. And his family said that they actually had worried, especially for his safety that day. And he even said leading up into his death that he felt a little more at risk than he normally did. When he arrived to his home on that evening, after he got out of his car, he was struck in the back with a bullet that was fired from a 1917 rifle, and the bullet actually passed through his heart. He was thrown to the ground by the impact of it, but he didn't die right away. Mm-hmm. So he actually got back up and not walked, but I guess like staggered about 30 feet. I mean, because he just got shot once. So mm-hmm. like I said, like
through the heart?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it actually went through his heart, but wow. he didn't die immediately. He got back up and he kind of stumbled a little bit more towards his house, and he collapsed outside of his front door. And his wife was actually the first to find him, obviously, because she knew that he was coming.
Yeah.
Home. Yeah, so she opened the door, and she said that her and the kids heard the shot. And the kids actually said that when they heard the shot, they all ran and hid, like, in one of the guest rooms. Because he had taught them, like, the drills and things like that. So, even when the kids heard the shot, they knew immediately what was going on. And his wife knew what was going on, too. And they actually took him to a local hospital in Jackson once his wife found him. It actually wasn't going to be admitted into the hospital because they didn't accept black people into that hospital at this time. And the only reason he was admitted into this hospital is because his family explained who he was and how he was a really prominent civil rights leader. And then they actually let him come into the hospital. And he was actually the first black person they ever had admitted into that hospital. Ever. Period. In life. And the only reason they did that, like I said, is because they knew that he was a prominent mm-hmm. Civil rights figure. And I guess they didn't want that smoke. They didn't want that bad publicity. But he actually ended up dying in the hospital about an hour later from his wounds. So it's just one gunshot wound. And he ended up, you know, dying from that one gunshot wound. And he was actually only 37 years old at the time of his death.
Oh, my God.
Which is super young. And like I said, he was the only, I guess, in part of my notes, it's not just that hospital, I guess. It says that he was the first African-American to be admitted to an all-white hospital ever in Mississippi. Like, this had never been done. So, I guess they only did it for him, which, I mean, cute, I guess, but he still died. So, yeah, he's actually buried in Arlington Cemetery.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah.
I
didn't have no idea. I mean, I know now, but yeah, I was like, Jay will find that interesting.
Yeah, I do find that interesting.
Yeah, he's buried in Arlington National Cemetery because, like I said, he was a veteran. Mm-hmm. He got buried with full military honors.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and almost 3,000 people attended his funeral.
Wow. That's mm-hmm. Well, we still have a lot to talk about. But that's, I guess, one positive piece I will hold on to. I have so many questions.
What are the questions?
Okay, I just been thinking about it. My first thing is, like, so that the night he died, mm-hmm. There wasn't a police escort. Mm-hmm. Is there anything on that people are talking about? They suspect that basically the police basically plotted to... Mm-hmm. to murder him? Like, are they alluding that the reason the escort wasn't there because the police themselves murdered him?
Maybe not the police themselves. So, like, someone was convicted of his murder. We'll get there. Not the police themselves, but just the police in cahoots with this person. Mm-hmm. So the person who murdered him was actually a Klans member. Mm-hmm. His name was Byron Della Beckwith, which, what a goofy ass name. Della Beckwith. But yeah, so he was actually a Klans member and a fertilizer salesman. And he was a member of the White Citizens Council as well. So I guess at the time there was this, I was looking into it. So the White Citizens Council was, I guess, basically like a more socially acceptable Klan group. But he was also, a member of the Ku Klux Klan. So I guess it wasn't like totally bizarre to be a member of the White Citizens Council, but if you were like, oh, I'm in the Klan, it would be kind of like mm-hmm. weird. But they were usually one in the same.
Sounds kind of familiar.
Yeah, exactly. So that was kind of what they called themselves in the day, mm-hmm. and then like they turned to the Klan. So he actually was arrested on June 21st, 1963, for the murder of Medgar Evers. And as you can probably predict, he was tried by an all-white jury of his peers. And the jury actually was deadlocked. And as a result, they failed to convict him. And he ended up going free. And that's the end there. It's okay. But his wife, actually, Merle Evers, didn't give up. And she actually waited until a new judge had been assigned to take the case against her husband. And during the trial, they actually exhumed his body for an autopsy. And yeah, every time they exhume a body, I'm like, damn, y'all niggas went hard.
We always, I feel like we've talked about it a few times.
It's so wild.
Man, exhumed bodies is crazy. Do you remember when they like took like James Brown's body out the ground?
So, I feel like we talked about this, but I don't think they did that. Did we have this conversation? I don't
think they took James Brown's body out the ground. Someone tell my mother that. Are you sure they did not?
I'm pretty sure they did it. I'm pretty sure we had this exact conversation on a different episode.
I know we did. At a minimum, though, I'm pretty sure somebody tried to, though. At a minimum. Didn't they, like, exhume somebody's body on Power, too? Like,
I don't watch that show.
All right.
This girl watches trash-ass Power but won't watch Game of Thrones. Make it make sense.
They say this is a big rich town. This come from Forest.
Man, I'm dead. But
look it up.
Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Let me know. In the meantime, I'll continue on with the info on the case. So
James Brown's body cut up for paternity test.
Girl, is that on Stars or whatever? I mean, that did not happen. There's no fucking way that they cut up James Brown's body and I didn't know about that. There's no fucking way.
I don't think they did.
There's literally no way.
I don't think that did happen.
You're reading like, what's that? The Inquirer.
The NY Daily News.
Girl, no.
There's so many ads on the site, I can't even read them.
Yeah, but anyways, exactly.
I say all this to say, yeah, I don't think they took his body to the ground. But somebody tried, okay.
I'm sure somebody did try. But yeah, so they actually exhumed his body for another autopsy in the second, because he didn't get, I guess, acquitted. They just, like I said, they deadlocked on the verdict, so he never got acquitted. So double jeopardy doesn't apply in this, you know, situation. So he actually lived for like a free man is like almost 30 years before they went back and, yeah, it was a long time before they went back and exhumed the body. And he actually ended up, long story short, being convicted of the murder on February 5th in 1994. Like I said, which was almost 30 years after he had, committed the murder. And he died at age 80 in prison on January 21st, 2001. So he actually didn't die that long ago. He tried to appeal his conviction many times, but the Supreme Court upheld it. Not the Supreme Court, but the Mississippi Supreme Court. They upheld his conviction, and he got life in prison, and like I said, died in prison at age 80. So, there's a positive end to the story. Yeah, he got off scot-free for like 30 years, but he did die in jail. So, the conspiracy. It's pretty, you know, obvious who killed him and for what reason, but the only conspiracy that I could find, which, you know, was interesting, but I just thought it was like, you know, an interesting story. The only conspiracy that I could find was just that the Mississippi police force actually went out of their way to be in cahoots with this man, Byron Della Beckwith. He, like I said, he was a member of the Klan. A lot of the police force were members of the Klan, and they were really kind of like tired of Medgar Evers, like sick and tired of him. So they basically, the idea is basically that they conspired together with Byron Della Beckwith and said that, you know, we will tell you the days when we won't be escorting him home. And we'll tell you the days when he'll kind of be like open for, I don't know, easy access.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can basically get him like a sitting duck.
That's what I was
thinking. Yeah, like a sitting duck. And, you know, we won't have to do our jobs because, you know, if they're there and they don't do anything to help him or save him, that will look fishy.
Exactly.
So to tell him, this is the days when we're not going to be with him, camp out in the bushes and go ahead and take your shot and we'll see how that goes. That's the only conspiracy that I could think that I came across. But I don't think that that's that far out of the realm of possibility at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't even necessarily even call that a conspiracy.
Yeah, I don't really even think like it's a conspiracy.
Said, it's super not far-fetched. But, I mean, I've looked at the definition of a conspiracy like 1,000 times. So, technically, it's a conspiracy.
Technically.
But yeah, that, I mean, that seems, like, completely possible to me. So, I don't have any doubt. The other thing I was thinking is, like, maybe, so like you said, he really did ruffle some feathers. Like, a lot of people really were like ready to kill this man. So I'm thinking, like, even without the police's assistance or the police like tipping somebody off, I feel like to think he has like a regular schedule, someone might have just been camping out like every whatever day watching his movements, and they're like, today there is no police escort. They just took their shot. Because there's people who are like, I guess the word is like a stalker. Mm-hmm. Like, so someone who just watched his movements and saw the opportunity and took it and was just waiting for the day.
Yeah.
But I do think that, like, it's more obviously that the police helped and allowed them to finally get, like I said, like a sitting duck. But I don't put it past that someone really was just so committed to murdering him that they're like, oh, wait. And they just waited and waited and waited.
Yeah, that's possible too, which is like I said, get a fucking life. But yeah, that's basically all I had. I just thought it was an interesting story and an interesting, you know, background about somebody that I had never really heard of before. So yeah, like I said, I believe that the police probably were in cahoots with this man. I believe that's probably why he got off for like 30 years and never went to jail. And, you know, the only reason that he went to jail later on in life was because his wife was like, yeah, no, I'm not going like that.
Yeah, and
like,
good for her that she actually got that done, because, man, 30 years later, that's insane. But I think this might be one of the very few Kodak Conspiracies episodes that has some sense of justice to it.
Yeah. Yeah, because usually nobody gets served justice. Usually it's just like, well, who knows?
I guess we'll never know.
I guess we'll never know. I know. this one's like, I know. That's pretty much all I have. So hopefully you guys just found it interesting and, you know, learned a little bit about somebody that you, or at least maybe not you, I don't want to speak for you guys, but a little bit about somebody that I didn't know that much about.
I learned. I appreciate Taylor. Thanks, Taylor.
Yeah, no problem.
I feel like we do a lot of half history, half true crime, half nonsense. And that's like a bunch of halves. That's three halves.
The haves and the have nots. But yeah, you guys, so like I said, this one it's the second to last episode before we go on break. So we have this episode and then one more next week, and then we'll be gone for 2 weeks. So just anticipate that. I don't even get no DMs like, hey, where's the episode? And I'll be clearly you didn't listen till the end. But not even that, because I told y'all niggas at the beginning too. So I'll be confused if I get any DMs talking about where's the episode. I'll be very confused if I get any DMs.
Literally, I think I'm going to try to do something, I don't know, Black Santa Claus segment.
What do you mean?
Like something Christmas themed for my something.
Oh, for your episode?
I'm gonna try to pick something like holiday-ish for people to enjoy before the holiday. It'll be after the holiday. Maybe I'll talk about how
it'll be before the holiday.
Oh, I'm like, maybe it'll be the 23rd. How black people like didn't get powers on the 21st. Like maybe by then.
Yeah.
We'll see what happened.
Okay. I was like, yeah, I just got that.
Oh no, I'm having something festive, so
Hey, if you have any holiday themed episodes for Jay that you want her to run down, feel free to contact us.
I know what I could
talk
about, but I'll tell you in private.
Okay. All right, fine. On that note, we're Cognac Conspiracies on Instagram, cognacconspiracies@gmail.com. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode and enjoyed yourself. See you guys.